Maybe you last Googled somebody before going out on a date, or if you're an employer, maybe to research a job candidate. If you're applying for a job, maybe you Googled your interviewer to find out some good conversation points. But when was the last time you Googled yourself? Do you know what's out there on the World Wide Web about you? There are plenty of stories about people who lost their jobs because of their personal blogs. In fact, it's become known as deucing in honor of Heather Armstrong, the author of the blog deuce.com, who's believed to be the first to be fired because of her online musings. And what about your profile on Friendster, MySpace, and the Facebook? Google Images call up photos in a snap. Even the almost famous may find themselves profiled on Wikipedia, and there are whole sites devoted to rating and talking about other people, like DontDateHimGirl.com, the RateMyProfessors.com, even the Rate Your Students blog. Combined, all of this information adds up to a sort of virtual identity that may or may not accurately reflect your true self. Today, how to manage your online character and your legal and technological options. Later in the show, Peter Sagal and Carl Castle join us from NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. But first, dealing with your online self. If you've ever been surprised to find out what's online about yourself, if you tried to correct or eliminate it, if online information has ever helped or hurt you, join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, the email address, talk@npr.org. Our first guest is Anna Marie Cox, author of the novel Dog Days and Wonkette America. She joins us here in Studio 3. Nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
It's good to be here.
Can we actually control our online personas?
You can control your persona. I'm not sure if you can control what other people say about it or what people can find out about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that there's so much out there. Your intro talked about even the stuff that people kind of opt into, the things that they write about themselves. There's a privacy issue, which has some you know, legal boundaries. But then I think there's another issue which has to do with what you posted on your blog when you were 18,
mm-hmm.
What you bought at Amazon and rated, you know, the things that you yourself put out there. I think people don't realize, like, that stuff lives on forever.
Forever. And at this point...
Well, it might as well live on forever.
Yeah, well, it's all archived somewhere, isn't it?
Right.
And at this point, do you suspect you'll ever run for public office?
Thank God I never even planned to. But I'm certain that I couldn't. I've only been sort of actively present online. Well, I mean, I had a blog for 2 years, and before that, I have to admit, I was online rather early. And it's embarrassing to go back and see stuff written that I wrote in the 1990s when I was in graduate school, mostly embarrassing because it's so pretentious. But also just the fact that it still exists it is kind of sobering.
I don't think anybody has ever lost their job because of high-flown metaphors, but it's possible. Nevertheless, this does seem to happen. I mean, there's so much information available about people on the web. Employees would be crazy not to Google.
That's true. And more people are getting online, too. So the chances of finding things have increased. I think the best we can hope for is so many people get online, we sort of have a life-size map of the world issue,
mm-hmm.
where it becomes just impractical to look for things online about someone because it would just reflect the exact same kinds of things you could find out in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, I think that for every new person that gets online, there's a learning curve of how much of what going online does to you. And so many people, unfortunately, find it to be kind of a freeing experience.
Aha.
Where they feel like they can say things from behind a certain kind of barrier that they wouldn't say in real life.
Is it worth it trying to stay anonymous or to stick with your scream name of Hubba Hubba 123 or whatever it is?
I think there's some pretty good privacy software out there. However, I also think that there are also lots of good detecting to be done. And I think that as good as the privacy software gets, the way to get, you know, to get through it also, the technology also increases.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of throw my hands up at it, which is perhaps an unfortunate thing. I should care more, be more proactive. But I tend to think that the best thing you can do is just go ahead and, it sounds kind of dirty, but Google yourself,
mm-hmm.
And find out what's out there. And that's what you can control, is you can control what you have to say about it, and you can control kind of how you might spin it to your boss,
if you're going in for a job interview or something like that, know what's out there so you can respond to it if he brings it up.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Lindsay calling us from Aurora, Ohio.
Hi.
Hi, Lindsay.
I just wanted to call in and say that I'm a student, and I'm a senior in high school, and a lot of my friends have either a Facebook or a MySpace, and teachers actually pull them up, and they often see pictures of kids at parties or read blogs about what these kids are doing on the weekends and in their private lives, and it's definitely affected how some of the teachers at my school view some of the people that I know because of what they have. It's just, like, damaging to their reputation.
I can understand why. The other part of it is there's that famous old Who song about you'll be there when I die tattoo. All of that stuff that you guys are writing today, it's going to be on the web somewhere forever. It's never going to go away.
Exactly, and I never thought about it, like, until I heard on your show, but, like, I'm definitely going to get rid of my MySpace now. The last thing I want is...
And yet getting rid of it might not even sort of undo the damage, because at this point so many people have seen it, or maybe not so many people. I don't know how popular you are, Lindsay. but it exists out there. And, you know, it's interesting. I do think teenagers are the people that really we have to kind of... I don't know if we have to worry about, but it's the age, it's getting online as a teenager where I think that freedom to express yourself, which teenagers do all the time in their diaries and their journals, and they write bad, rock songs about their failed relationships. But now there are MP3s of those bad rock songs, you know, online.
and
I guess there's even more serious stuff, it sounds like you're saying, like things about going to parties and maybe like underage drinking and whatnot.
Right. I mean, it's a matter of time before the police start using this to, like, know what kids to look for.
They already have. I read somewhere, I think at one of the Ivy League colleges, they started monitoring MySpace journals for invitations to parties. Although there's a nice punchline to that story, which is some students got together and they heavily promoted a beer party. And sure enough, they had on the appointed night, the police showed up and discovered hundreds of cupcakes that had the word beer written on them. So there are ways to get back, but take down that profile. Yeah,
spoofers could be inspired. Lindsay, thanks very much. Good luck.
You're welcome.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Russell. Russell from Fort Myers, Florida.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I'm an attorney, and I had the privilege last summer of representing a couple of clients in a very high-profile case, and there were articles and interviews and of every shape and description all over the news media. And what blew my mind was that about a month or two afterwards, I decided to Google myself just to see how many different articles had finally been written about me and my clients and such. And I found about 300 articles about the case, but I found about another 20 or 30 different websites that had remarkably personal information about me. My kids' names, my wife's name, the date I got married, where I graduated from high school and college, my hometown, you know, just all this information that I never even occurred, 'cause I'm very, very careful about my privacy. And I just, it kind of blew me away how much information there was out there.
It's a little scary, isn't it?
Totally frightening.
Let's bring in our lawyer here in the studio. Jeffrey Rosen is with us. He, of course, is a professor at George Washington University Law School, author of the forthcoming book, The Most Democratic Branch, How the Courts Serve America. And Jeffrey, it's always a pleasure to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be here.
And I wonder if you could respond to Russell's fears. I mean, this is enough information that if a dark stranger came up to you in an alley with this sort of information, you'd take it as a threat.
Absolutely. So what to do about this? As a lawyer, Russell knows that the law is a very bad mechanism for protecting privacy. Basically, these lawsuits never succeed. To be illegal, the information has to be highly offensive to a reasonable person. And in an age of Pamela Anderson Lee videos showing their honeymoon intimacies online, there's almost nothing aside from hidden cameras in bedrooms that everyone agrees is highly offensive. It's an old problem. Ever since Louis Brandeis lamented a gossipy item about his law partner's wedding breakfast, which inspired the most famous article on the right to privacy ever written, people have struggled in American courts to come up with a way of formulating legal responses. I'm not much more optimistic that they're going to work in the 21st century than they did in the 19th and 20th. And that's why, in some ways, technological solutions may be better. Russell, I wonder if you've heard of these great... There's one great new technology not so new anymore, called Scribble, that would allow you to go into these blog sites and selectively delete at least inaccurate information. So how about some technological self-defense as a response to all this?
Well, we'll have more on those availabilities a little later. But Russell, is there anything you're prepared to do?
Well, what's interesting about that is that I did find some information from really strange sites, like the place I got married, the church that I grew up in, had a lot of my personal information online, and I found it as easy as just calling the priest and saying, hey, would you mind taking my stuff off the website? And they said, no problem at all, and they took it all off. So I think that there was nothing inaccurate. Everything that was there was shockingly accurate about me, and I think that was what was so frightening. If it was inaccurate, I guess I wouldn't worry as much, but it was very accurate, and that's what gave me some concern. But overall, I'm not the most personal information. I was able to just contact the people who had the websites, and they, you know, took it off without any difficulty. I don't think that they thought that they were doing anything to upset me.
Okay. Anna Marie?
I think in all of our discussion about technological sort of defenses and legal defenses, people probably should remember that actually picking up the phone is probably the best first thing to do, or sending an email. I mean, I do think a lot of times people just don't realize, like the first caller, they just don't realize what they're doing with this information. And to simply send an email and ask politely, it's probably going to avoid a lot of heartache.
Hmm. The problem is you need some sort of ongoing relationship. As you know, some women, for example, have asked guys who've blogged about dates to take their names off because they know that this could hurt them with future employers. But if it's a site that has no interest in maintaining a relationship with you, they can ignore it, and therefore you're in trouble.
Yes, but still, you have to ask.
You have to
hope that there's some shred of decency.
And it also probably helps if you're not a public person. They might be more inclined to keep that information on you if you're well-known as opposed to if you're not. Anyway, Russell, thanks very much for the call. Good luck.
Thank you.
We're going to have more on this when we come back from a break. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, you can dial 800-989-8255 completely anonymously and get on the line with us, or send us an email, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A simple web search will pull up all sorts of information on most people, and we wonder, since this program started, how many of you have decided to Google yourselves, and what have you found? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guests are Anna Marie Cox, Wonkette Emerita, and author of the book Dog Days. Also Jeffrey Rosen, professor at George Washington University Law School, and author of the forthcoming book, The Most Democratic Branch, How the Courts Serve America. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Michelle. Michelle calling from Alaska.
Oh, hi. I was just calling with my experience in using Google as an employer, and I'm a mom, and I was looking for a nanny, and I got all sorts of references on this one woman, and she came to my house, and I really liked her, and I, you know, essentially hired her, but I had to do a background check, which I did. I did an online background check, and I called my husband, and I said, I found a nanny. You know, here's her name. I did a background check. It was great, and he said, well, let me Google her name. And he Googled her name, and up came a reference to her blog. It wasn't actually her blog. It was her, I don't know, some friend's blog that led us back to hers, which, you know, my favorite things are, you know, Charles Manson's and guns and all these drugs I'd never even heard of.
Mm.
And then it went on to talk about her experiences with the children in the family for which she was previously a nanny, and how, you know, I was out all night and got smashed and went and took care of those brats and, you know... And then I really struggled with if I should call this mother with whom I had spoken. She lives across the country, but it was, and say, you know, did you ever notice that this woman had this blog? And so yeah. I had to come up sort of with a reason not to hire her. And also I decided not to call the mother because the woman had moved away. It didn't really affect her, but I felt bad for this other person who had essentially been duped by this this gal.
Anna Marie?
I have a question. Do you actually feel like the other mother was duped? I mean, she gave a good reference for this woman, right?
I know. I guess not. I guess if it was my children, though, and someone was writing the things that this girl had written about, you know, this woman's children, I would be really afraid, frankly, that this person was taking care of my child. And, I mean, her children, you know, were fine and not hurt, but I don't think, you know, I think her children were probably, based on what she wrote, and who knows how much of it is true, you know, she wrote things like that she had been up on, I don't even know the names of all these drugs, but on drugs all night.
She Googled them.
Didn't take care of the kids and put them in another room.
And Jeffrey, she said she had to make up an excuse for not hiring her.
Which was a polite thing to do. But what a wonderful example. This is the best one we've had all day because it's an example of privacy violations at both ends. The woman violated her own privacy and therefore was deuced. Mm-hmm. She lost the job because of things that she revealed on her blog. But she absolutely, I agree with you, violated the privacy of the family in the most appalling way. There's a nice review in the latest Atlantic by, there's a piece by Caitlin Flanagan reviewing nanny diaries of women who kissed the kids and told. But you have to be the nanny to Mike Ovitz to get a book contract to write a book like this. Nowadays, in the age of the internet, any nanny with a modem is a potential mini Wonkette, maybe Wonkette-ette or something like that. And so all of us, if we hire nannies, have to run the risk that the nanny is frantically blogging behind our back. It's such a vile violation of boundaries on so many levels to have the woman to whom you're potentially enlisting your children describing the domestic sphere. Aristocrats, you know, used to sign non-disclosure agreements. The Kennedys did this in the White House, made their nannies promise not to kiss and tell. I almost wish there were some additional punishment, not just not getting the job, but some public shaming. All the mothers could get together and write a blog about the woman. That would be great. Absolutely.
I don't want to defend this woman too much, but I also think that a nanny is a very particular job, let's say, where you might want to be more concerned than usual about someone's emotional state. But I do worry about employers going and looking at someone's blog and seeing, let's say, those heartfelt lyrics from you know, lovelorn high school days, mm-hmm. or when you had suicidal thoughts because Jerry or Joe dumped you, and reading something into that about their future employer when all the references are good, when all the grades are good, when everything that you would get normally on paper about a candidate is fine, and not just on paper. When you go back and look at who they've dealt with professionally, but something in their personal life. Upsets you in some way.
So maybe a norm.
I guess what disturbed me most was sort of the violence. I mean, it was a lot about guns and.
The Charlie Manson reference would definitely give me pause.
Yeah,
there's no question about that.
I do think you have a very specific case. I think.
But Anna Marie has a nice point, and you could have a norm develop, whereas if you only violate your own privacy as a kid, you write about your favorite rock mm-hmm. lyrics, you get a pass in the same way that it's possible to get a government job if you smoked pot 15 years ago but not 10 years ago. On the other hand, if you violate someone else's privacy, if you write about the family without their consent, that really reveals a flaw of character that should disqualify
right.
you.
Right. I agree. I think that there are sort of different we are developing categories and boundaries as we speak
mm-hmm.
about
yeah.
this,
yeah.
And that is going to happen more and more.
Michelle, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
We were talking, Jeffrey was talking about this lack of standards, which makes it so difficult to figure out what's right, what's wrong, what's legal, what's illegal. And one of the things, Anna Marie, you were saying is that the standard over who is a public figure is indeed changing because of the web.
It is so much easier to be famous now than it used to be, to be a public figure within a certain public, let's say, mm-hmm. within a certain, you know, subculture. I often talk about famous for D.C., and I can tell my mom, hey, mom, you know, I went to Tammy Haddad's garden party. And my mom's face will be completely blank because that person is not famous outside, you know, the 20008 zip code. But is she worth writing about? Like, is that something that if you talk about, you know, her or me, do they qualify as a public figure because they are public within this small realm?
Mm-hmm.
It definitely changes the legal debate. The standard for being a public figure, it's a very perhaps salacious phrase that Justice Powell came up with. You have to thrust yourself into the vortex of the public debate. And if you do that...
That sounds like Wonkette material.
Well, we're all thrusting ourselves into the vortex nowadays, which makes us all potential public figures, which means we don't have much of a legal remedy. But the problem with the public figure, non-public figure distinction is it doesn't capture the real... indignity about being written about without your consent. There's a wonderful article about gossip that E.L. Godkin published at the turn of the 19th century. He said, think of the difference between spoken and written gossip. Someone gossips about you behind your back. You can ignore it. You don't have to respond to it. It's not an assault on your public face. By contrast, once the thing is written about and archived, you have to dignify it with a response, calling more attention to it and therefore having it potentially more damaging. Nowadays, now we're all public figures. We're all being gossiped about in ways that's recorded and written. What's the remedy if it's not law? We need to develop these norms as we are in this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Susan calling from San Francisco.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have sort of a cautionary tale that touches on what your guest just spoke about. I kind of inadvertently thrust myself into the public
vortex.
Being written out in a kind of unusual, I am a former law clerk to Justice Alito during the nomination process, and as a liberal feminist, there was interest in talking to me and gave some interviews to the kind of mainline press and Googled myself, my name with the name Alito, and it was kind of fun, sort of seeing go from like 50 to 450 hits. And then during the hearings, I was invited to a room full of relatively young bloggers, and I'm also an attorney. I'm in my 40s, and I guess wasn't very sophisticated about this. And I spoke to these bloggers, and overnight, it went to like 120,000 hits.
Does that surprise you, Anna Marie Cox?
No.
Well, it totally surprised me, but I think really the cautionary tale is that many of these sites that recorded my interview and some things I'd said were interactive sites. So I got to read all these comments about all these anonymous people that were responding to what I had said. And you know, as your guest just said, you are being written about. And although my privacy wasn't invaded because nobody could really, I mean, they could track me down if they really wanted to, but my personal information wasn't there. But because it was a politically charged subject, there was a lot of name calling, and it was quite upsetting. And just to read this and know that there were hundreds and hundreds of people out there either thinking I was a traitor to my liberal allies or a moral degenerate because of my beliefs. So I'll think twice before speaking to a room full of bloggers again, I think.
You will, and we all have to, and not only bloggers, because even in a classroom, anyone is a potential blogger. In the old days, you could have said, this is off the record. You're just going to speak to a group, but you don't want it published. But in the blogosphere, there's no way to enforce that. And Reed Hunt, the former chair of the FCC, told a group of bloggers at Yale Law School that the class was off the record. They ignored him. They blogged about him. And he said, from now on, I'm just going to assume that everything I say. Al Gore, Professor Al Gore, made the same mistake when he tried to make foolishly his Columbia journalism class off the record. But it's almost like we have to negotiate what's on the record and off the record in every area of life. After class, I could be being blogged about without my consent. I can say this is off the record if the students have a blog about me, which is a law blog, and talk about my weird mannerisms in class. I'll be angry at them. I'll try to shun them. You know, this will disturb our relationship. But it's very hard on a case-by-case, individual basis to negotiate the boundaries that journalists and sources are used to negotiating all the time.
That retaliatory F doesn't work anymore.
that would be a harassment, probably, or violate some other legal shoal.
I do wonder how this is going to evolve if we are just going to from now on assume that our entire life is on the record, sort of what you alluded to, like outside of class on the record, what you say at a bar on the record, or if the blogosphere will grow up, you know, if people will start to be able to make distinctions and to censor themselves in a perfectly good, you know, ethical and moral way.
Oh, that happens so often everywhere else.
I know. I know. Yeah.
Anna Marie Cox, I know you have to leave.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It's
appreciate
been great.
It. Anna Marie Cox Wonkette Emerita, and also the author of the novel Dog Days, was with us here in Studio 3A. And Susan, by the way, thanks very much for the call. I think Susan has left us. I think her cell phone battery was leaving us even before she did. A couple of interesting emails. This from Dwight. As an example of not being able to undo what you have done online some 20 years ago, before most of the web existed, I was active in a Usenet news group about urban legends. I posted some information about the play Sweeney Todd that ended up being mentioned as a contributor in the byline for the group. Fast forward to a few weeks ago, I was in a job interview, and the person interviewing me asked me about Sweeney Todd. He had found my 20-plus-year-old posting and found it interesting. 20-year-plus posting. This from Laura. I just Googled myself, and there are a lot more interesting people out there with my name. I didn't see myself, but I saw a popular musician, an artist, several psychologists, students with blogs, poets, etc. Maybe I should adopt an alter ego or two. How boring if you're Googling and it comes back a blank. It's all interesting. Anyway, let's get our next guest on the line. And this is Andy Cernovitz, a CEO of the Word of Mouth Marketing Association. He joins us from the studios of Chicago Public Radio. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Glad to be here.
And we're calling you in hopes that you can give us some advice on how to manage our online selves. I understand you work mostly with companies to help them manage their reputations, but individuals, online personalities, what advice would you give to people on managing that sort of virtual self?
The first rule above all else is have good humor. And there's a lot of people out there who are going to write a lot of stuff about you, whether you like it or not. So you have to learn to sort of expect it and accept it. And then there are some specific strategies that you can use to respond.
And they are?
The quick rules are do respond. You know, as we've talked about, there is a permanent record out there. So you do want your side of the story on the permanent record. But you don't need to win. You know, the goal isn't to get into a battle or to prove your case. It's just to let people know you have a different perspective on what was written about you.
Mm-hmm.
The second rule is be calm and credible and don't look crazy. And it's awfully easy to look crazy when you're angry and you're typing and you're arguing, you're so upset that somebody wrote about you. And above all else is learn when to let it go. That I think as more and more people are writing more and more random garbage and more top-of-mind information is on the web, at some point the public is learning to recognize what is real, valuable editorial words, and what is people gossiping.
The rule of thumb that I've used is if I find myself writing in capital letters, time to take 10 deep breaths and think about it again.
Exactly. Mm. And it's hard to avoid getting into a fight, which is the worst thing you could do.
Because you can't win.
You can never win. You know, when someone writes about you, especially on a blog, you're always playing in their playground. You know, they own the media. You know, if I argued with you on your show, you get to come back tomorrow, and I don't. So I'm not going to win that fight. Online, it's the same thing. Is, you know, you can tell your story. It'd be wonderful if you had your own web page to say, I disagree, check out my blog.
Mm-hmm.
But the more you fight, the more you dig yourself in deeper.
That suggests that you have to monitor the developments about your online personality fairly closely.
It's a good idea if you're at all public. I mean, if you're, you know, professional, you know, in the work world, it couldn't hurt to use Google, as other people have said. There's also a great website called Feedster that specifically looks at the blogs, and you'll find stuff about you more often than you think.
That's interesting. Now, are there any technological avenues that you can fall back on? I mean, this stuff is cached somewhere. It's all recorded somewhere, even your responses. But is there any way you can get it to be eliminated?
No, is the short answer. There's a fascinating website called the Wayback Machine, and you find it at archive.org. And it has not only every website that has ever been on the web, it has every version of every website. So you can go back to a specific day and time and find a specific version of a web page before it was taken down or changed. So go to archive.org and check out your history from 96 or 99 or 2002.
Jeffrey, is there legal recourse if somebody writes something defamatory about you on the web?
Sure, defamation is actionable, but what we're talking about here mostly is not defamation and slander, but the publication of accurate private facts. These are things that are true. They're not defamatory, but nevertheless are embarrassing and personal. But even defamatory information or even legal remedies for stuff that might be actionable if it's true are hard. Anna Marie left, but the best example of this is Washingtonian, the woman who both sold her favors for money and then blogged about her relationship, including with a consensual boyfriend who was identified on the web. All of his intimate information and activities were exposed. He was so upset, he said, you know what, I'm going to sue. It'll be embarrassing. It'll call even more attention to me. But I'm not a public figure. I'm a private figure. And it's outrageous that this woman, Washingtonian, so violated the privacy of our relationship that she described our intimate activities. He might or might not win. The standard is that it has to be highly offensive to a reasonable person. The lawsuit will be embarrassing because even more of the intimate activities will come out in the course of discovery. It's expensive, but it's the counterargument to your guest's excellent idea of letting things go. He felt that there's some point that is crossed that's so outrageous that it was just a matter of honor and he had to go to law to vindicate it.
Mm-hmm. Laws about libel and slander in this country are very difficult. In Britain, where it is considerably less difficult, have there been cases where people have been sued for what was published about somebody else on the web?
Sure. Sometimes they win. If you are really in trouble, find a British source for the website and go sue there because they don't like the First Amendment the way
okay.
we do.
Andy, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Andy Cernovitz, a CEO of the Word of Mouth Marketing Association, joined us from the studios of Chicago Public Radio. We'll be back with more on this after a short break. And also our thanks to Jeffrey Rosen. Appreciate your time as always, Jeffrey. This is NPR News. In a few minutes, Peter Sagal and Carl Castle join us. Wait, Wait comes to Washington. But first, managing your virtual identity. All this online information poses a fundamental question about how we define public and private in the internet age, also how we define ourselves in a digital world. David Weinberger has been thinking about these questions. He's a research fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. He joins us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Nice to be here.
The internet is really an area we're still sorting out, public versus private. Jeffrey Rosen and Anna Marie Cox were talking about that earlier. What a person posts on their Friendster profile and limits to their friends is not necessarily limited to that intended audience. Are there cases in which that information is used against them in employment situations? How do we as a society wade through this?
Well, we're figuring it out. I mean, the magnitude of this change is hard to overestimate. So, of course, we're going through a very, very difficult transition period as the norms that we've developed over the course of centuries about what constitutes private and what constitutes public, as those norms change, of course, it's a very messy time. So there aren't good answers, and there can't be until we actually work through these issues, which will probably take a generation.
Mm-hmm. And the fact is, all of us have gotten accustomed to living our lives as an expression of our character. If you talk to our friends, our family, people who know about us, you'd expect that they'd give you a fairly accurate reflection of who we are, what we stand for, what we're about. That's not necessarily true of that other avatar of ourselves that's out on the web.
Well, ourselves offline have always been way more complex than I think frequently we're willing to acknowledge. That how we appear to others, depending on the social role and position, is always quite different than how we appear to yet other people in other circumstances. We have some control over that. We try to look nice. We try to dress nice as the statement of, nevertheless, we know we don't have really good control over that. On the web, the public is gigantic. The amount of time that your appearance is permanent. You know, what you wrote 20 years ago, as we heard earlier, is there forever. And this means that we need norms not just for how we express ourselves, not just as writers, but we also need new norms as readers to figure out what we're allowed to pay attention to. You know, when you walk down a street, we already have this well worked out in the real world in public. So when you walk down a street and you overhear a conversation, you have to act as if you didn't overhear it. It's very rude to acknowledge that you heard it. And we have very sophisticated rules that tell us when we're allowed to hear things in public. We need the same sorts of rules, but they're going to be slow to develop and very painful to develop. We need the same sorts of rules for how we participate in this new public of the web.
There was something you wrote that I was very interested in. You said our public online selves are more fully social than our private corporeal selves. What do you mean by that?
So we have this idea that in the public world, in the real world of the public, that we have an inner self and then we have these layers of outer self that we can control and we're either sincere and authentic or not. Online, all of our presence is stuff that we write. It's all public. There's no inner. It's all stuff that we do outer. It's a different and there's much more play possible there as well. You can adopt a new identity. You can take a new name and play with that for a while. And especially younger people do that with some great regularity. Mm-hmm. That interjects directly into our sense of self, an idea of play.
But this sense of, you know, of play, liberation, you can be whoever you want to be on the web, as we've also seen, this can come back to haunt you.
Absolutely. And so there's two types of learning we need to do. But more important, there's two types of norms that need to develop. Because right now, it's not like there's a code that we can learn and a problem will go away. We need to develop these norms. And one set of norms have to do with what we consider to be an appropriate as writers, what we're allowed to write about. Mm-hmm. So maybe, as we heard, it will turn out to be, as I hope it does, really inappropriate for a nanny to blog about the inner life of a family. But it's also important for employers and then for all citizens eventually to understand that everybody is going to have written stuff they regret. And we need a norm and a culture of forgiveness because otherwise we're doomed.
Interesting. Similar things have happened in radio. These days, live programs like this one are transcribed. They're permanently recorded somewhere on the web. Of course, when I started out in radio, thank heavens, all those programs are no longer to be found anywhere except maybe in the vicinity of Alpha Centauri as they zoom out there in space. It's such a relief to me to know that all of those programs will never be heard again by anybody. But
And you've been on your best behavior during these shows.
Well, yeah, but it's still, it's like Anna Marie Cox said earlier, some of the stuff was so pretentious, you just cringe at the idea of hearing this. But our younger selves are going to be around our whole lives.
But isn't there hope in the possibility that we're going to recognize that we're all like that? We all say an enormous amount of stupid things that we regret. We say them as youngsters inevitably because we change and grow. And if this transparency across time leads us to recognize that, she was just 16 when she said that. Mm-hmm. If we get a better sense of what's forgivable, then this is something that I think is really, really good. We can drop the pretense of perfection.
David Weinberger, thanks very much.
Thank you.
David Weinberger, research fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, with us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. This last email from Botan on this subject. I'm a Kurd from Turkey, and for the last couple of years have been working in the U.S. with an H-1B worker's visa. Since I'm an equal member of the society in this country, unlike my prior one, I felt quite safe and free to make all sorts of political comments regarding the Kurdish struggle on web blogs and mailing lists. To my great surprise, later I find these comments were being tracked by the authorities back in Turkey, and I was warned about this in a real crude manner while back there on a family visit. So my point is, make sure to keep an anonymous identity, not just for job safety, but in some circumstances, for the very safety of your life. When we come back, our guests from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.